doing it.
Okay.
I think it's so expensive to keep them.
Yeah, that's the problem.
I'm going to open up the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and anybody who isn't here yet is going to have to stay late, according to Representative Gomberg. We know that Representative Gelfser is not going to be here. Representative Kenny Geyer will be late, and I'm not sure about Representative Leininger. With that, we're going to open up the informational hearing. We're going to be changing the order. And so we're going to have the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board annual report. And if the members would come up, that would be great. Please just sit down and introduce yourself. Colleagues, I sent everybody the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board report, sent it all by email. It's also available on OLIS. And I think you have it printed out in front of you in addition. So you don't need to read from this, Becky.
Not going to.
Good. Thanks so much. Go ahead.
Greetings. My name is Corbin Vonick. I'm the chair of the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor. Basically, I'm going to introduce Becky, but I would like to go over the work group that I participated in, Representative Tomei, and we were focusing on a very, very crucial component of Oregon State Hospital having to do with community reintegration, the movement of patients from their place at the state hospital into the communities in Oregon. And we identified several important components to look at, including and foremost housing, places for people to live so that they can leave the hospital, financial vocational support, peer support, family and other support groups, counseling services, medical support, and cultural support. We identified a lot of barriers in terms of reintegrating patients into the communities throughout Oregon. Part of that's due to the stigmatization of mental illness and the discrimination. Part of it is due to the age-old problem of anywhere but my backyard. And a lot of it is due to the fact that there aren't enough beds to get people transitioned from the state hospital into the community. So we had a retreat 2.5 years ago or so, and we identified several important things to look at, and Becky's going to summarize. And after that retreat, at every advisory board meeting, we revisit where we've gotten and how far we've proceeded as far as community reintegration, safety of patients, seclusion and restraint, a lot of really important issues, and Betty's going to summarize our growth there. And, by the way, this is the look of retirement. So, I just wanted to share that.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Good morning or afternoon. I'm Becky Child. I'm a member of the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board, and I've been involved with the advisory board since its inception. And I would like to start off by calling your attention to page 2 of this report. There's a chart on there that talks about people who are ready to be discharged from the state hospital. As of December 31st, there were 87 people who were ready to be placed in the community at the hospital. Of those 87, 42 had been waiting more than 90 days. If you do a dollar figure, because we want to be good stewards of public dollars, at $945 per day, at a minimum, we've spent $8.1 million for everyone who is ready to be placed at this point. That would provide for a lot of services for folks in the community. It also is not in agreement or concordance with the triple aim of providing health care.
That's what that is, Becky.
The triple aim is providing health care at the least cost and improving the patient's experience, keeping people who are institutionalized in institutionalizations when they've been told they're ready to go is really demoralizing to them individually and causes other problems and exacerbates their recovery in their own health care and life. Also related to that is that there are a number of issues in terms of having patients who are classified as 370 coming into the hospital.
They're just what that is.
Those are people who've been deemed ready or unable to aid and assist. There is a high turnover. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but that is also an issue that's been called to our attention that we're quite concerned about. And I believe, and Superintendent Roberts can correct me if I'm wrong, but five counties are responsible for the majority of those patients. It's Multnomah, Clackamas, Lynn, Marion, and Lane counties.
And do you want to explain to the committee what that means, aid and assist, where they're coming from,
so
and how
they
long,
have,
and what are they waiting
they
for?
They are in jail. They have been charged with a crime of some sort, and the judge and or the attorneys involved have said that they're not able to help them in the defense of their trial. And so the hospital has a program to work and see if they can get them ready to aid and assist. Most
in
people
their own trial, right?
In their own trial. Most of them do return back to jail. There are a few who don't. And stay at the hospital for a longer period of time. But I'm sure that he can talk more about that. Another issue that I'm understanding from people in the community is in community hospitals, we have people who are boarding in the emergency room. For somebody who's having a mental health crisis, the emergency room is the last place you want to be. And people are staying for multiple days in the emergency room where they basically... in good cases, get their meals and showers, but I've advocated for people who didn't get a shower for 5 days, who people, they think they might be going somewhere, so they hold off on their meal, and so they wind up going 8 or 10 hours without eating. And that's not really any one person's fault, but just kind of the inefficiency of the system in able to address people's needs. And in addition to that, the emergency rooms are really harsh for people who are hearing voices, not feeling well. The intense fluorescent lighting is not good for folks who are experiencing psychiatric distress or emotional distress. The other committees that we've been involved with from the board, we've focused on patient safety, and in that we look at injuries to staff and to patients. We also look at the use of seclusion and restraint. I just recently sent some questions to the hospital around concerns I have around their policy and questions I have about their current policy, and they're looking to update it. We look at other policies such as their emergency medication policies and things that come to our attention through various ways, either people that we know who are currently patients there or staff that work there, family members of folks who contact us. And the other committees that we have also include treatment planning, and so we're looking at how we provide person-centered care in the hospital. And one of the biggest challenges that we are currently having is that we are down in the members of our board. We have a very difficult time getting people through the governor's office and then to the legislature for approval. Some people have applied and have waited for more than 9 months and have not heard a word. And right now we currently have a committee of 5 people. We're supposed to have 11. And while we are still doing the best work that we can, we are severely hampered in what we can do because we only have 5 people. And then the other thing I want to take a moment to say is the hospital staff have worked really hard to provide us data, and I just want to take a minute to recognize how hard they've worked and that we're generally delighted with the changes that we've seen that happened from when this board got started and what happened before that in creating this board. So I just have to say thank you to the staff who worked so diligently and hard to improve things at the hospital. There's still a lot of work to be done, but they really have worked hard.
Indeed, they have.
So, thank you.
So, can you remind me how long this board has been in operation?
This is my starting of my second term, so I think we've been 4 years
mm-hmm.
now.
At least 4.
Yeah.
I think
mm-hmm.
longer, but yeah. You'll have to check that out.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, any questions? Representative Gallegos.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at these numbers, the wait list that you have of 42 getting placed out of 87. I had two questions. One, so that's about a 50% rate of people being held back and not being able to get placed. Is that typical, so nearly 50% of your folks have to wait like 90 days or so?
So there generally is around 90 people that are waiting to be placed. That's not 50% of patients at the hospital. That's just, and also I should note, Superintendent Roberts just told me that the person who's been on there for more than a year finally got placed this last week. And one of the challenges that I think that people that they encounter is when there are people who need services from different DHS agencies or either seniors or persons with developmental disability services, that intercommunication is really challenging for the agencies.
Follow up. Following up on that question, can you expand a bit on this lack of ability to place? I mean, whether it's lack of housing, whether it's lack of, NIMBY is going on, and then also, do you have sufficient discharge planning staff? I mean, is it a staffing issue as well? I mean, what?
The process is somewhat complicated because of the various bodies that determine when a person is ready to be placed in a lower level of care, which is generally support the community, basically. So you've got the Psychiatric Security Review Board, you've got the treatment staff at the state hospital, and then you've got the community-based treatment center all working together to approve a particular patient's transition. Needless to say, having been the executive director of community-based programs, I can just say this from my experience, not generalize it towards anybody else, but there's a tendency to want to accept the people that you are more certain will be successful in your program, and there are certain restrictions regarding persons in the hospital that may have had a crime, a conviction of arson, for example, or sexual assault. So there are a lot of mitigating factors. The person may be ready at the hospital, and according to the PSRB, ready, and the community-based program has the right, if you will, to not accept the patient. So that's one of the issues that we're looking at now, which I think we talked about with Representative Tomei about the possibility of it might require some legislative action to kind of synthesize these entities to make it more expeditious. Is that a word? Expeditious. I made up a word. I like that. Expeditious in transferring patients from the hospital.
Could I follow up to that also? Also, some of the challenges are that for patients that they reach a certain privilege level within the hospital, if particularly for people who are under the Psychiatric Security Review Board, the community placement that they go to requires them
Becky,
to basically...
Before you say more, I'm not sure everybody knows. I know we've talked about the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Just do a refresher of that, who they are and what they do.
The Psychiatric Security Review Board is the board that's responsible for people who've committed crimes, who've been pleaded guilty except for insanity, and are in the community. And there's a two-tiered level system for different types of crimes for people currently in the hospital. But once they go to the community, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, or PSRB, is responsible for overseeing their jurisdiction. The issue is that they reach a certain privilege level in the hospital. When they go to the community providers are requiring them to basically start at ground zero, and you have very little privileges. You don't get to go anywhere, and people don't want to go because it's like treating them like children. And I've talked to numerous patients that just say, "Why would I want to do that?" I get to go to school here. I'm doing these things. I get off-grounds privileges. Why do I want to go back and start all over again? And so one of the things that we've talked about, is there a way to bring the community providers in earlier and have them start working with patients while they're in the hospital so they get a chance to know them? And I know that part of the reason for the providers is that it's a risk issue, and they want to minimize their risk. And so there's got to be a way to figure that out. And then the other issue related to that is that there are a few people who don't want to go. That could be they've been there for so long that they're severely institutionalized, mm-hmm. and they don't know anything else. For some people, it may be that they don't like the placement options that are available, or the criteria that they would have to live under if they were in the community. So that it's mm-hmm. a few people's, but it's not a large number by any stretch.
And I'm glad Very Becky well brought done. That up, because mm-hmm. a lower level of care assumes that you've progressed enough to not be so strictly have that kind of strict oversight, and yet the patients that have weekly visits with families and stuff like that go to a secure residential a secure residential treatment facility, and no passes, they lose everything. And so there's got to be a way to address that, as Becky was saying. I'm glad you brought that up.
I think it's important to let people know too that it's very difficult to site these placements in the communities. We did this in Milwaukee, and it was extremely mm-hmm. difficult. The public is very worried about these. I'm not even going to use the word, but people who have committed crimes when they have a mental illness.
I actually have and a recommendation for that.
Let me finish.
Sorry about
that. Get back to you. That's okay. Yes. And actually, the recidivism rate is less than 2%.
Yeah.
The recidivism rate for somebody leaving the prison system is almost 30%. So the public's perception is that these are potentially dangerous people. Right. That is not accurate. Uh-huh. That is not accurate. But that is the perception. So that's one of the reasons why I think these homes feel like it's so important to keep mm-hmm. people in a contained setting.
So I need to frame my suggestion and recommendation from, I come from a disability rights perspective, in that I believe in community integration it's not least restrictive care, is how do you get people, because people are engaged in their life and in recovery. They're not a risk to the community or anyone else. And so if we were to look at different forms of placing people in their own homes or with in an apartment with somebody, and not staffing people in 15-bed facilities, I think that's a mini institution, basically. I mean, how many of you would like to go live in a 15-bed facility? Anybody? You don't get to choose who your roommate is. You don't get to choose who your housemates are. You just get to go there. And if we looked at providing wraparound services, either through assertive treatment teams or different ways of providing services, I think we could, NIMBY is not an issue at that point, mm-hmm. because it's an individual person or two in an independent housing situation.
Thank you, Becky. Representative Whitson.
So how many of the 42 that you presently have waiting are people that have refused to go because they don't like the conditions, the terms of their release, if you will?
I don't have the answer to that. Maybe Superintendent Roberts can speak to that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know it's not a very high number. It's one or two, generally speaking. It's not even 10, usually.
Okay. I have another question.
Sure.
So when you say that they go to the emergency rooms and that they are staying in the emergency rooms,
mm-hmm.
who pays for that, and what is the cost? And don't most hospitals have rooms if there's psychiatric hold parts to hospitals?
Yes. So counties are the payers of last resort. So if somebody is indigent, then the county ends up paying. But that doesn't mean that they don't try and take their money from the individual if they have any kind of income whatsoever. I know people who've been given $30,000 or $40,000 bills for their stay in the hospital, just really didn't have a means to pay it, even though they were working minimum wage job or something like that. Yes, they do have psychiatric hold rooms, but those are for folks. People usually end up there because they don't have a place. The units are filled to capacity. They're not comfortable rooms. They're not designed for the comfort of somebody who's experiencing emotional distress. They're really bare rooms with little stimulation. There's really no... They might bring a TV in or something like that, but sometimes TV can be the worst thing for somebody in a mental health crisis. but it's just not really designed well to meet their needs.
And somebody might be able to answer how many psychiatric rooms there are in hospitals.
Yeah, there was
communities.
An editorial to in the Oregonian today's what the last couple of days by Sharon Mirren, who's an emergency room physician, that kind of speaks to the issue of patients being held in the emergency rooms.
And we'll, let's get that out. That was an excellent editorial. We'll get that out to all the members.
I have just a follow-up. So somebody has to pay for them to stay, and obviously they can't pay. Is it the county? Is it the state? Is it the hospital?
So
who pays for what it actually costs them?
So it depends on their status. If they have a notice of mental illness, then the county is the payer of last resort, so the counties are responsible for their payment of their services there. If they are not on a notice of mental illness but are still are there voluntarily, they are on the bill. If they have insurance, their insurance is on the it will be paying. If they don't have insurance, then the hospital will try and get it from them, or they wind up absorbing the cost. I do know that in some places in Oregon, that because counties were concerned about getting, or the hospitals were concerned about getting paid, that doctors would put people on notice of mental illness even though they really didn't qualify for that status, that they were there voluntarily, but the doctors would say, we're going to put you on hold so the county will pay, which isn't right either. And I don't know if that practice is still going on, but I do know that it has happened in the past.
Thank you, Becky, and thank you, too, Corbett. Thank you. Any last questions? Thank you so much, and
thank
thanks
you.
For being on the board. Really appreciate that. And Representative Olson reminded me it was started in 2009. We're in our fifth year. Terrific. Okay. We're going to, and I'm glad you brought up housing, both of you. We're going to be having a panel of folks. Greg Roberts, Pam Martin, Director of Addictions and Mental Health, and Kevin McChesney from the Oregon Residential Provider Association. Greg Roberts, of course, is the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital. And NAMI has some materials that I think we've distributed to you. Thank you for coming. Thank you. Go ahead, Greg.
Representative Tomei, would you like for me to start out with a U.S. DOJ report?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
And we sent out that letter also from John Dunbar, who is the attorney in charge of the Special Litigation Unit from the U.S. Department of Justice.
So thank
and so you had met with them in January, right?
Yes, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. We met with them for 2 days in January 8th and 9th to discuss the 4-year agreement that had started in November of 2012. The point of the agreement is to improve the service delivery system, in particular for individuals with severe and persistent mental illness, SPMI. And so we did meet with them for 2 days, and I believe you have the letter that they sent about that meeting that was dated January 24th. We felt, and I believe that USDOJ indicated that the meetings were very productive, and one of the important things we did was to look at the first 3 quarters of data that we had produced and to look at the problems with that information and to try to dig into it and to look at the data elements and to make some improvements.
Pam, could you sort of start us off with what their concerns were and have been for several years?
Well, it's my understanding that kind of nationally, some of the main issues that have driven the United States Department of Justice to look at other states have been issues that started really with the Olmstead decision by the Supreme Court in 1999. In 1999, the Supreme Court ruled that a mental illness was a disability, so the people who have mental illness have all the rights that anybody with a disability has, and in particular, the particular case that was being addressed had to do with two women, both who had mental illness, and one also had developmental disabilities.
Pam, I don't think you stated your name for the record.
I apologize, Chair Tomei. For the record, my name is Pam Martin. I'm the Director of Addictions and Mental Health Division for the Oregon Health Authority.
Thank you, Pam.
So there were two women who had developmental disabilities and mental illness, and they had been in an institution in Georgia for much longer than their treatment team thought they needed to be there. So it's not unlike what Becky described, where only in a, I think this was an extreme case where the treatment team had determined that these two people would be comfortable living in the community, they would be safe, they could, you know, have a life in the community, and they're just, they were in a more restrictive setting. So there have been there's been work done in Delaware, in I believe South Carolina, and in Georgia, to name a few states, with the U.S. DOJ examining the mental health system with particular emphasis on people with severe and persistent mental illness to make sure that they have an opportunity to stay out of hospital or out of jail or other incarceration and have a full life in the community. That's why I think our discussion about housing today is so pertinent, because a foundation for all the things we're talking about is a safe and affordable place to be, and what we like to say is, you know, a key. Everybody deserves a key to their own home. So that's the context. So, but as part of that...
If I can just interject. So if I recall, one of the criticisms some years ago, probably 8 years ago, you were here at that time, was that the state hospital was certainly in a terrible place, and so there was the suggestion that we build a new state hospital, which happened, but also concurrent with that was we needed to build more community programs to keep people in the community so they wouldn't go into the hospital, and also to get them out of the hospital. The hospital is a place to go to get well. You don't live there. You move out of the hospital. So that sort of, we've done the hospital thing. We've built a great hospital. Now, I think the shortcoming that we had was that we did not provide sufficient community services. Now, am I sort of saying that correctly, Pam?
Absolutely, Representative Tomei. That hits the nail on the head. So that the services that we are looking at are all the kinds of services that you might imagine that would be helpful in keeping people out of the hospital. So crisis services, jail diversion services, support in the community, like peer support specialists to work with people, supported employment, all the things that help people stay in their community. And then if they do need hospitalization, to make sure the hospitalization is as brief as possible and that people are appropriately, you know, back into the community, back to their lives. One of the directors of a federal government, the SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, was a social worker, and Mr. Curry used to say, "What everybody needs is a place to stay, a reason to get up in the morning, and a date on the weekends." And I think that really, really describes what all of us need and want, companionship, friendships, meaningful work, and a home. So those are the things that we're working on in our community. And you're absolutely correct that the first step was to do a great deal of work at the with the state hospital. Which I think Greg Roberts will talk about in a moment. And so we are working, I think, very effectively with U.S. DOJ, and we're meeting again with them in March. We've sent them some revisions to the data matrix. We're trying to do a better job defining having a data dictionary to define what our data means, sharing information about the things that we have done, to including the creation of an Office of Community Activities to increase consumer voice in the Addictions and Mental Health Division and at the Oregon Health Authority, and to create new projects and to build on existing programs that have been successful, such as assertive community treatment teams. Assertive community treatment teams are really an evidence-based practice that have been shown nationally to be very helpful for people who need a high level of services, perhaps for a brief period of time. Each assertive community team has a psychiatrist, nursing support, social work, peer-delivered services, and the innovative thing, which doesn't seem very innovative anymore, but at the time the innovative thing was that these teams went to where people were. If people wanted to meet at McDonald's or their homes or under a bridge or wherever, these teams, you knew an assertive community ACT team was doing well if you went to visit them and there was nobody there, that they were all out in the community seeing the folks that they were responsible for. And this has proven very, very effective. We in Oregon are working with a center of excellence to make sure our existing and new teams that who have been will be coming brought up with some of the new mental health investments achieve fidelity. In other words, that they adhere to the model that we know works, and then can help people. We are working very hard on the Olmstead issues as well. Oregon was one of seven states to be chosen to participate in an Olmstead Policy Academy, which has been sponsored by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, and it focuses on how best to serve people in the community. Oregon developed an Olmstead plan in 2011. It needs to be refreshed and reviewed, and we are engaging our planning and advisory council, Olmstead Housing Committee, to do that with us.
And that was 3 years ago. So how has that proceeded?
The Olmstead plan has many of the mental health investments and many of the projects that were defined in the Olmstead plan have gone forward, but some have not. So it's time, for various reasons. So it's time since we have new investments and some new people on board and a lot of support and collaboration with the state hospital. It's a really good time to take another look at it.
I hope there's more than a look at it. I hope there's some progress.
To just make sure that the plan aligns with everything else that we're doing strategically. And doesn't just sit in a drawer. Yeah, I want to make sure it's working. We also have received some good advice and counsel from the United States Department of Justice, who steered us towards some of the work done in Delaware, and we've had a two-hour meeting with my fellow mental health commissioner, Kevin Ann Huckshorn, and her U.S. DOJ team, and gotten some really excellent ideas about what they've done around housing and some of the things that they've done. They're in the third year of their Olmstead plan.
So, Pam, what I'm hearing is you're getting information and you're making plans. I guess what I'd like to see is what's happened on the ground. I noticed in page 2 of Mr. Dunbar's letter in January that, according to the settlement agreement, there were supposed to be one or more drop-off centers for first responders and public walk-in centers for people with addictions and behavioral health needs. And not one center in Portland has been established yet. Help us understand why that is. I mean, I understand you're trying to get information and other ideas, but I guess what's happened on the ground? What can we count on?
Representative Tomei and members of the committee, we have put the mental health investments out in the community now. They're 18-month programs, and most of those contracts are out, and the money should be getting to the community. We will bring back in September a great deal of information about how that money has been used to establish more mobile crisis teams, more housing, rental assistance, a number of things. I also have a meeting with the city of Portland and other people on my team as well to discuss that very thing, the drop-off center issue, which
who's responsible for that? Is that in your agency is supposed to be paying for that? Is that supposed to be the city of Portland? Who's responsible for setting that up?
Representative Tomei and members of the committee, I think that may be one of the topics of conversation at this meeting that we'll be having.
Who's going to pay for it?
Who's going to pay for it? Yes, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Pam, I'm looking at this one website right now that's the PASS Center, which is Personal Assistance Services, and they have listed right now that Morgan does not currently have an Olmstead plan developed, and there's nothing in the works right now from what they're saying on this website. I mean... Wow. This is interesting. I find this interesting.
I would have to get referred to the website. I have the plan. I've reviewed it. It was developed in February of 2011. We've brought it to, we have an USDOJ advisory committee with outside members. We talked to them about it at a meeting last week, and they were aware of the plan. Bob Jundeff was on that committee, and he agreed with me that we needed to revise, refresh, and rejuvenate the plan. So I'm afraid I'm not. I can't comment. Sorry.
That's okay. I just pulled up.
Okay.
So February 11th, 2011, right, is what's dated. I find it fascinating, though. You got. I'd be curious to know what's going on with that website saying that.
It says in his letter that the city leadership, I'm assuming they mean the city of Portland, has attempted to convey to the local CCOs and the hospitals this expectation by the United States. I love it how he uses the United States, not ours, but not him personally, but he's saying the United States expects this. The responsibility to make this happen rests on the partners responsible for mental health services. The state, I think that's us here, that's... You two, especially, Pam.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And counties and the CCOs. And I'd like to hear also, I know I'm interrupting you and you probably have more to say, but I want to hear the CCO's part in this also, especially on the last page. If the CCOs, the CCO contracts provide a higher percentage for CCOs to become financially responsible for individuals under their plan who are placed in a state hospital, if they were responsible for their patients, $250,000 to be in the hospital, you can assume that they would be very eager to find some housing for these folks, for some wraparound services. So it's somewhat offensive and bothersome to me that we're saying this is going to be the state hospital's responsibility, our responsibility. We've set up the CCOs. It seems to me, I'm hoping that you're going to be putting their feet to the fire, too, that you're going to say you need to take some responsibility for these patients that are under your care.
So, Representative Tomei and members of the committee, we consider the CCOs our partners. And we are collaborating with them on many of these issues. For example, the assertive community team funding is going directly to the CCOs to develop 9 new assertive community teams. So we have there's money already in their budget for ACT teams, and they're getting more. And then many of the I also am in touch with the and meet regularly with the CEOs of the COOs and with the behavioral health directors of the COOs. So we're working collaboratively with them on a number of these issues. The behavioral health providers who are contracted with and, you know, working with the CCOs are very concerned about the full range of services for people with severe and persistent mental illness. The health care part for people with severe mental illness is absolutely critical as well. I imagine that many of you have heard that there's a huge gap in longevity between people who have severe and persistent mental illness and people who don't. It's over 25 years. So it's very vital that people get good health care, and dental care is very helpful too. A lot of the medications that people take create metabolic problems, high cholesterol. We have a large number of smokers in this population. So the CCOs are very actively trying to, they are working actively on embedding behavioral health providers in their primary care clinics to help people. And conversely, we're working on programs that are mostly behavioral health programs who are embedding primary care in those programs. So integration and reverse integration. So the CCOs and the whole health part of our healthcare transformation is extremely important for the population that Greg and Kevin and I are involved with. We just don't want to forget. This 25-year gap needs to be narrowed for people.
We certainly agree with that. I seem to be controlling this, but one of the issues brought up was the crisis on the third page. Fragmented county-based crisis hotlines. I'm sorry that Representative Gelser couldn't be here today, but at one of our meetings, she talked about an experience that she had, that someone was concerned about committing suicide, and they called the crisis line. If anybody has anything to add to this, and they were on hold. They asked them to hold, and then finally said, "Could you call back tomorrow?" Obviously, our crisis, this is in Benton County. We're not talking about remote Wheeler County. We're talking about Benton County. What is it that, these crises, obviously, these people are in crisis. What is it that we're doing on the ground to make sure that these drop-off centers, the crisis hotlines, what are we doing about all of that? And that's, I think, we want to hear what's happening, not meetings and more input from other people. I think we'd like to see some results. Anybody adding to my concerns? I'm hearing some.
I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. But, you know, at the same time, I it would be interesting to know what Sarah Gelser experienced, what Representative Gelser had seen with that over there in Corvallis and Benton County, because I got to admit that Frank Morris here from Linn County Mental Health, and I've gotten to know him quite well on working. We've had him here before. But his department is very responsive, and I know that he's worked closely with Benton County, too, on a number of issues. I can share a number of cases where they really jumped in and helped me, too, with individuals. I would really be curious to know what that was all about.
Yeah, and we can address that at another time. Yes, Representative Whitson.
I think, for myself, what I'm trying to figure out is how much money has been spent in the last 3 years, as related to how many people have been helped. Are we still in the planning phase? I'm a little confused. I'm like the chair. Are we still working on a plan? Or what's...
Representative Tomei, Representative Whitson, and members of the committee. Actually, I came prepared today to talk about housing, and I can tell you that since 2004, there's been over $3 million put into housing and leveraged, so awarding funds to 27 cities and 20 counties statewide to increase the statewide capacity of apartments for people by around 260 and by about 100 residential facility beds. So I think there has been in different areas, there have been investments. The thing about these funds is that they came from the community health, community mental health housing trust that was a result of the Damage State Hospital sales. So AMH, and certainly not AMH alone, but AMH in this case has expanded the capacity for the residential capacity by about 360 units for people. Now that's and one of the important things that this is this $3 million was leveraged with almost a one to 20 match because we worked with community providers, and the leveraged funding came from federal funds and private grants and a number of places. Now I'm not saying that 360 units solves a problem at all. There, I'm sure that there are several thousand people who are in need affordable housing, but I can certainly return with clearer statistics as you're asking for in other areas other than housing in terms of the real things that have happened and the real advances that have been made.
Tim, I noticed that you're going to be having a meeting in March with the U.S. Department of Justice, and we'll be having another committee meeting in May. I'd like you to come back, and if you could, I'm sorry if there was miscommunication. I thought we also were going to be asking you to talk about the federal investigation. That certainly is on the agenda. And so that was one of our strong interests here. So we'd like you to come back in May, and we'll have another meeting, September, I think. Isn't that correct? And on you're going to be meeting quarterly with the USDOJ. Come back and meet with us, too, because we have a strong interest in this, and especially the things that I mentioned, the drop-off centers, the crisis hotline, supported housing, community services to keep people out of the hospital. And also, maybe we should invite the CCOs, because I think that is another important issue for us. What kind of involvement and responsibility are they going to be taking to keep people out of the hospital where it is between a quarter and of a third of $1 million a year? So I think that's one of our big interests. So thank you. And we're going to move on to Greg.
Yes. Could I just ask one clarification?
Sure. You said 3 million spent in housing since 2004, so that's 10 years, and then you said it was a 1 to 20 match, so do you mean 60 million then equivalency?
The 20 million was leveraged to be 60 million. We also have a $4.2 million rental subsidy program that we just started with 8 providers around the state, and we can report out to you now or at some other time. There's also an additional $10 million, and that we want to use half of it in a partnership with NAMI, National Association for Mental Illness, and the Oregon Residential Provider Association, to try and create more of these public-private partnerships where we leverage funding. And if there's an opportunity for Kevin to come in on that, that would be helpful.
Great. Thank you. How much did you say that was, the NAMI partnership?
They sent a letter to us. I think you have that. We sent that by email earlier today. And
you mentioned a million amount, which is how much?
They mentioned $10 million set aside for mental health housing.
Okay.
Sorry if we put you on the spot.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Greg Roberts. I'm the superintendent at Oregon State Hospital, and I have a presentation to make. But I think we're going to select some particular topics from that to have a.
And everybody either has this
at the dais, or they have it by OLIS.
Right. So I'm prepared to answer any questions about all of this, but we want to focus on a few things. And just as a context of this, as I listened to the previous discussion, I think what's interesting to consider is that back in 2006, the U.S. Department of Justice came to Oregon to focus on the state hospital, and as they've done in about 40 other states, we're looking at compliance with a federal law called CRIPA, Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act, and certainly found a number of serious deficiencies back then at the time, which in part led to the decision to build a new facility. As has happened in many other states, the focus then is on the state hospital, and not so much ironically, but coincidentally, as the hospital improves, and the hospital has improved, the hospital is a much better hospital today than it was in 2006, the other issue emerges in terms of community mental health treatment, because the hospital, as Representative Tomei has said, is a place for healing. Our mission is to provide care and treatment to our patients so that they can recover and return to the community. And then that creates an issue in the community. So to some extent, the better we do our job in the state hospital, the more people become ready for placement, and then it's an issue of the appropriate placement, housing, and services in the community. So this is, in my opinion, at least, sort of a natural outgrowth of the focus on the state hospital where the question for U.S. DOJ began. Before we get into some of that, I want to just point out some of the highlights. And I do want to express, related to the Hospital Advisory Board, how important they have been to the improvements at the state hospital. They've been very closely involved. We've had, from time to time, more than the current five members. We've had, from time to time, all 11 seats filled, but usually there's a vacancy or two. And I can't complain, because the five people who are left on the board right now are high-quality people, and they do a great job. And they've been involved in the improvements that I have listed. I think it's important for the committee to know we've recently gone through a reorganization of the hospital, clustering our patients according to their legal status. So certain units of the hospital are now reserved for people who are guilty except for insanity. Others are for the 370 patients who are there for the aid and assist. Seven units there.
The aid and assist.
Aid and assist population. Others are for civilly committed people, and now only three units was four when we began the biennium. Now only three units are for people who are geriatric and or people with severe medical problems who also have mental illness. And that is in part, there's a lot of reasons for the reorganization, but one of the driving forces was the closure of the Blue Mountain facility in Pendleton, which increases the need for beds at the state hospital for civilly committed people. Blue Mountain only treated people who were civilly committed. And related to our preparation for the opening of the Junction City facility about a year from today. So we have three units already aligned at the hospital who would be moving lock, stock, and barrel to Junction City in about a year. We've also focused on two of the issues that are commonly discussed here are the use of overtime, especially mandatory overtime at the hospital. There's been good progress there, especially on the reduction of mandatory overtime. On the issue of patient aggression, some good work, again, lots of planning and discussion for a while, but now some implementation, especially training of direct care staff that has begun to show to bear fruit. We caution everybody to say it's a little early to call things a trend, but we are seeing some downward movement in some of our metrics related to aggression and injuries to patients and staff from aggression. The ready-to-place issue we'll talk about, but I know especially Representative Gallegos is a fan of lean methodology, so are we. We've continued to implement lean methodology very importantly and very thoroughly throughout the hospital. We've now reached the point that lean daily management systems are visible at the unit level, at the patient unit level, and we have selected some standard metrics for the hospital on important issues: seclusion and restraint use, use of precautions, attendance at treatment malls, in the geriatric section, patient falls, and in the civil commitment program, the length of time it takes for someone who's ready to place and move to the community, how long does that take? So many of the improvements that we can cite at the hospital do devolve from the use of lean methodology. There's been good progress also in, if we were to go back a year or two, Senate Bill 420 was passed and House Bill 3100 related to the creation of the State Hospital Review Panel for lower level offenses, leaving the Measure 11 offenses for PSRB, and the number of patients in the hospital who are guilty except for insanity is at its lowest point in many years.
That's
and the number of admissions is also, so that is a sign that more community treatment is being provided to that population, which enables us to be able to release, conditionally release, or fully discharge even GEI patients to the community, the guilty except for insanity population. We continue to implement our electronic medical record program. Probably too strong of a word as a struggle, but it's been a bit of a rocky road, and forward progress, but we've hit some issues here and there on some of the implementation. So I would say we're about 50% implemented at this point, which in itself is a problem because that means half of our medical record is still on paper and half is in electronic form. So, but there's good progress there. Provision of treatment, which is the core mission of the hospital, is going very well. We continue to operate 6 treatment malls. 85% of our patients attend the programs that are outlined in their treatment plan. That's a discharge-oriented plan. That's a very high percentage. I can tell you from other states where I've worked and other hospitals, our 85% treatment participation compares to about 50% in most other state hospitals. So that's really a tribute to the staff who work on the units and in the malls. Family services is a specific topic we worked on with the Hospital Advisory Board.
Oh, excuse me.
I just had one question while you were there, because I'm not sure I'm looking at what you are, but in terms of following participation, how about success rates compared to other places around the country?
For your Representative Kenningeyer, success rate for?
For participating in this, they participate in it.
In the treatment?
For the treatment plans, what's the success rate?
The answer to that question would actually rest in how frequently that we then need to revise a person's treatment plan, because the plan would speak to a specific goal. The person goes to the treatment mall for treatment. Actually, that would relate to the aid and assist population as well. So if the sign of success is the need then to revise the treatment plan because the patient has reached the specific goal, then it's a very high, that's a high percentage. The number of people who we treat, especially in the 370 program, that's a legal education emphasis so that people can aid and assist their defense and attorney, and we've reduced our length of stay. We've increased the number of people who are restored to competency and reduced their length of stay in the hospital so that they can return. But you'll hear in a minute to how that's created a different problem for us.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's effective treatment, and Oregon State Hospital does an excellent job of regularly receiving consumer feedback. Our treatment malls run on an 11-week semester of sorts, and then we collect data, feedback from the patients as to what worked for them, what didn't work, what they want more of, what they want less of, which I think explains why such a high percentage of our patients attend their treatment, because they had a major role in designing what treatment they desire.
Is that sufficient? Okay, thank you.
Family services was one of the issues that the Hospital Advisory Board pointed out as we could do a better job there. In the past year, we tripled the number of staff in that office. It was a one-person office. Now it's three, and we're much more attentive to family issues and family education. We're running some programs even on weekends now for family, and we're getting good feedback there. And then provision of medical care, which 4 and 5 years ago was one of the major reasons why the hospital was had such a set of problems, that and some of the more infamous patient deaths that occurred at the hospital that led to the USDOJ visit were attributable to inadequate medical care and treatment. As Pam said, people with mental illness have a life expectancy that's 25 years shorter than ours. And part of our obligation was to examine the provision of medical care and treatment. We created a Department of Medicine for the first time in the history of the hospital. We've hired some excellent internists, physicians, and nurse practitioners. And some of you, I know, have been to the hospital and seen our clinic building and the services we provide. So when you look at the metric where unexpected deaths due to inadequate medical care, that does not occur any longer at Oregon State Hospital.
I'm going to speed you up a little bit.
Yes.
There are three things I think this committee is interested in, is mm-hmm. the aid and assist population. 61%
yes.
of the admissions, almost 62% is aid and assist.
Right.
And also, we want to talk somewhat about overtime.
Okay.
And
ready to place, I think, as well.
Right, ready yes. to place, yeah. And patient to staff assaults. In the Judiciary Committee, we had a long presentation about assaults, and I think we should
right.
address that. But I think one of the biggest issues that we, those of us who were in the legislature when the bills that you referred to have been passed,
mm-hmm.
we had hoped to slow the admissions of people into the hospitals, that would be more more uniform in a sense, and also encourage people to be leaving the hospitals. And certainly I don't think any of us anticipated this huge number in aid and assist. So can we talk some about that?
Absolutely right. We have now reached the point, again, as you said, on the guilty except for insanity, good progress there, lower admissions,
mm-hmm.
and more discharges. Civil population, pretty stable, changes there. But the 370 population, these are people who are arrested for something in the community. It may be a very low-level misdemeanor offense, or if a significant, it could be a felony. And I can tell you, that, so at this time, throughout, for the year 2013, about 62% of all the admissions to the hospital were 370 patients, aid and assist, people coming in for evaluation of their ability to aid and assist their attorney, or for their services. If they were not able to aid and assist, then we provide programming and education so that they are able to aid and assist in their defense.
And as I remember, this population can cause a lot of problems in the hospital.
Representative,
correct?
Yes, as we correlate some of our data with aggression to type of population, yes, that we see high aggression on some of the 370 units, a high use of seclusion and restraint as a result. So
I think that's what we heard on the
right.
Judiciary Committee. Yeah,
right.
It's hard for the staff.
So for the committee to know, there are really two statutes to be talking about here. One is referenced as a 365 evaluation. That's the initial evaluation that leads to a finding as to whether a person is able to aid and assist their attorney. But as you were saying, the law does not require a person to have a 365 evaluation before they come to the state hospital.
And say what that is, please, what the 365 evaluation.
It's the psychological evaluation, the test to determine whether a person is able to aid and assist. So one-third of our admissions last year came to the hospital without a 365 evaluation. So we had to do the 365 evaluation, and if they determined that the person was not able to aid and assist, then we had to proceed with services there. But I think...
And there's no way you can turn these people away, correct?
Correct. We have a 7-day period once the court order is signed to admit the person to the hospital. So, but it's that's one issue that we would want to talk about in terms of possible legislative changes in the next session to require a 365 evaluation before coming to the hospital.
So let's move right into that.
Let me just mention one other stat,
okay,
and we'll get into that.
Okay.
The 40% of all the 370 admissions that came to the hospital last year were misdemeanors. 60% felonies, but 40% misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. So some of the reasons why a person comes into the hospital as a 370 person can be a relatively minor misdemeanor. And then a question arises as to whether the state hospital is necessarily the appropriate place for the restoration of competency services. So as we look to expand community mental health services, that would also be a recommendation from the hospital. So. Representative Temme, did you want to talk more about 370s then, or?
Any other questions? Am I the only person interested in that?
Yes.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
It's such a big area for me, and I'm not. And this is like my third session trying to understand the stuff, so it's very complicated. But we just came from a health committee hearing in which we heard from the Crisis and Stabilization and Crisis, the new name under DHS for one of this. I think it's a step down, but I'm not even sure if it's people that are not eligible for OSP, but an increasingly violent population. And so I just want to be aware of the big picture. We might be doing better here, but it might be because we're dealing with less of people that are now over here, and we're not doing a very good job over there. And some of the restraints and things that you're able to do there and tools that you have are not able to be used over here because it's a civil rights issue for the disabled, for the IDD or the DD population. So I'm just know that I'm trying to figure that out as you talk. We fix one problem, and then the problem goes over here, and I'm trying to figure out where are all the problems and where do they all fit in, and you're accepting different kinds of people than you did before, and where are they all going?
Representative Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. That's correct. I think that something we see is that an attempt to resolve a problem here creates a different issue there. There are certain laws about involuntary medication, for example, whether you can be involuntarily medicated in a correctional facility. You can in the state hospital. There's
right.
a process for that that comes into play. And then in some other settings, the ability to place a person in restraints, if that becomes
exactly.
necessary, is also
exactly.
an issue. So all those things come into play. Right.
Thank you.
It wasn't a question. It was just a response.
Yeah.
So yes, I care, but I'm like trying to understand
yes.
it.
Right.
So on page 4, you have recommendations. It was for overtime reduction, but also you were saying address the 370 problem. Mobile evaluation teams, expedite discharge. Also, pursue legislation in 1517. So follow up on that, please.
Pursuing legislation? Sure. Some of it's related to what I was just talking about, the fact that one-third of the people come in without an evaluation,
mm-hmm.
actually, that has determined whether they're able to aid and assist, would be something we think, I don't want to hypothesize, but I think it may be just something that was intended.
Yes.
I think everyone intended for people to have
yes.
a 365 evaluation,
yes,
but the law does not require it.
True.
So it would be
yeah.
something to
yeah.
Consider. The one consideration, this has to go through a whole process of legislative concept approval, but the possibility of eliminating misdemeanors from the 370 mm-hmm. statutes and reserve it for more serious crimes. And because a municipal court can sign a 370 order, in combination with the fact the municipal court can sign a 370 order without a 365 evaluation being done, would be something else that we'd possibly want to recommend. So,
and I would suggest
yeah.
that this committee seriously look at those to see what we can do to take care of those.
Madam Chair, real
yes.
quick, because I know you're, could you explain what the mobile evaluation to the pilot project in Marion County, what is that? Could a couple sentences about
Representative Wilson and members of the committee, sure. One of the, we have a 10-point plan or so to look at the 370, the growth in the 370 population, and one of them addresses that. That would be related to the 365 evaluation issue that we operate at the state hospital, what's called the forensic evaluation services, psychologists and psychiatrists who do testing and court testimony. And we're piloting, we're willing to have our staff go to a community jail setting to do that 365 evaluation, which would determine whether the person really needs to come to the state hospital for services. And if that were to be successful, then we would look to expand that type of services to at least the five counties that are probably 80% responsible for the 370 admissions.
Follow up real quick.
Follow up.
What was the bill number, sir? And what session was that passed, Director?
Two bills relevant. For that was House Bill 3100 in the 1113 biennium session, and then the other I mentioned was Senate Bill 420, which was geared toward the guilty except for insanity population.
2011, too.
Yes.
Thank you.
Greg, you have a lot more you want to tell us, and we'd like to hear it. But I think we're going to do that at a later date because we have a whole other group that's going to be talking with us, and we want to hear from.
Sure. I just want to end up with my usual line.
Go for it.
The Oregon State Hospital is doing much better than it did back in 2006.
Absolutely.
But we have a long way to go. We're better than we used to be, but we aim to be better still, and we will be. So, more to come.
Here, Pam. I just want to hear from Kevin.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Greg. We'll invite you back either in May or September.
Sure.
Kevin, thanks for waiting.
Thank you. My name is Kevin McChesney, and I'm president of the Oregon Residential Providers Association. And as you may remember, we actually, along with NAMI, co-sponsored a bill, House Bill 3332, last legislative session that didn't get funded. And then another $10 million for mental health services was funded during the special session through an increase in the cigarette tax. And we have since that time been recommending and now have a draft, a memorandum of understanding with addictions and mental health along with NAMI. To look at using $5 million of that $10 million for purposes of creating a housing fund, if you will. And the specifics of that really are that if we're able to do that, that we would limit use of the of that fund to 20% for the capital cost of new housing projects. And 50% of startup funds. And the whole purpose of that is really to leverage those dollars against private funds so that we can make them go farther. And I can assure you that if we spent all $5 million of that plus the additional private investment on housing, that still would not meet the need that currently exists in the state. The other thing I think that
clarification, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Kevin, could you please? The $5 million, the residential is the rental assistance. Is that including staff too, or just the housing?
Director Martin would have to speak to that. We haven't done anything with the Oregon Residential Providers Association has not been involved into the rent subsidy portion of.
Yeah, how about for your $5 million? Will that include counseling or professionals plus the lease, or is that just for the building houses?
It's primarily for the building of housing.
It doesn't do any good if we don't have the staff. We build a house, there's no professionals.
Well, yeah, and I agree. And in some cases, there will be services built into this, but
maybe that's the tobacco tax part.
His $5 million is a tobacco.
I think. What it speaks to is there needs to be that continued investment in things like assertive community treatment because what that really does is, what we're looking at really is a concept where we're providing housing, stable housing for individuals, and then we need to be able to wrap services around them. So this fund does not eliminate the need to invest in community mental health treatment services, like outpatient services, and then those specialty services like assertive community treatment. So that has to happen.
But not sufficient.
This.
Yes, yeah. Madam Chair, but I understand that, but you have to get your hand in the ground. What's that going to buy us, $5 million in housing and leasing or whatever we're doing? Because it doesn't seem significant.
Well, if you, it could be a substantial number of housing units.
Yeah. And it would not be the wraparound services in addition to that.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, it would not necessarily be a substantial number of beds in a treatment facility. And I think it's pretty clear that the Department of Justice has said that we really don't want the state of Oregon investing in residential treatment facilities any longer, that what they really want are these mixed-use types of development. And so I think a fund like this would be ideal for that concept, where you're really going to have a maximum of 20% of the individuals living in a development being individuals with a disability. And so private investors are going to be more interested in that, because some of those units will end up being for market rate apartments or for housing for people with low income.
We're so glad Representative Gilliam came back, because he's very interested in private public partnerships, which is what
I am.
We've been discussing.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
So you've been hearing this discussion with Pam and with Greg. Do you have any reflections on any of that, or suggestions or thoughts?
Well, I can tell you, as a representative for providers, that and somebody who's also been in this business since 1991, the entire time that I've been living in this state, we've been funding the need for mental health services at the community level at about 46%. So when you talk about a lot of these issues, it's not a surprise. It's really going to take a substantial investment to start to get the community mental health system where it needs to be to really move people through the state hospital, through the residential system, and get them into community placements. And then you add on top of that right now the fact that we're expanding the Medicaid population significantly on top of an infrastructure that's not very strong. It's going to take a while to start to catch up.
Can I spin off of a question with that, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Kevin, I guess actually, Pam, you're going to have to get plugged into this too as well. So I'm just kind of curious where we are at with the transfer of mental health residential through the CCOs.
I can answer most of that. I've been very involved in that process.
Okay.
It's been delayed a couple of times because of the complexity of the situation. There's about 700 and some residential beds around the state. We're now on target to actually make that transition occur on July 1st of this year. And it's a really incredibly complex issue, and I think one of the most important things to keep in mind about that transition is that the dollars that will flow to the CCOs as part of this pales in comparison to the primary care element of their business. But the risk associated with this population, the severe and persistent mentally ill population being served in the residential system, is very much disproportionate to the money that's going to flow with it. So I think it's really, really important that we develop a good relationship around primary care with those CCOs. And we're just now still in the planning stages of that.
I'm hoping this is something that we revisit on a regular basis, because I think that's where the answer is going to be. Rep. Sam Whitsitt, did you have all of you asked some questions about finances, the money, and who pays, et cetera. Did you have any? Did you sort of get the answers you wanted, or did you need something more from either Pam or you asked questions of Becky and? Okay. All right.
I think we can
talk offline. Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, really appreciate it. One last question.
Yes.
Superintendent, are you seeing an increase in your clients from the military veterans?
Representative Whitson and members of the committee, not that I'm aware. We do have some data on that, but I don't think there's been any real change.
Okay.
So.
The best is yet to come. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, we're closing the informational hearing on health system, residential, and state hospital. And we'll open up the hearing on the shelter facility for victims of sex trafficking. So we have Amanda Marshall, who's been so patient. Thank you so much for coming. Is Aaron still here? Marita Johnson and Amy Baker. Thank you all so much. Can we get another chair up there? Do we have to need another chair? Oh, terrific. Thank you, Marita. Great. Thank you for being patient and waiting. We really appreciate it. And we appreciate Pam and Greg and Becky. I think Becky's gone, et cetera. But who did I miss? Kevin. Yeah. So anyway, thanks for everybody who participated. So thank you so much for coming. So
thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you so much for inviting us to come here and talk to you today. Aaron just nudged me and said, will you get us started? So I agreed to say yes, because I'm not the shrinking violet. Although,
give us your name first, please.
My name is Amanda Marshall, and I'm the United States Attorney for the District of Oregon. But sitting here, I didn't think I'd come back to this room once I was no longer the lawyer for DHS, so it does feel like old home week. So thank you so much. I just want to really thank you, Representative Tomei, for inviting us and for the work that you've done, I think, really to sort of bring us together and keep us all going in this effort to do what we need to do to serve this very difficult and very vulnerable population of kids who are victims of sex trafficking. I'm just going to say sort of how we got here, but then I'm going to turn it over to other folks to report on progress of what's happened. But about a year ago, a group of us came together and started meeting somewhat informally, and much of at your request, Representative Tomei, initially here at the state capitol, and then when the legislature was not in Salem, at your home, which we very much appreciate. And we came together as government leaders from state, local, county, city, and federal government entities, and also with leaders from the NGO community and the faith-based community to really talk about what we can do better in Oregon to solve the issue around these kids who are sex trafficked and for whom we really have no solutions. One of the questions when we first began to have this discussion sometimes came from the media and sometimes came from lawmakers and policymakers and sometimes came from agency folks was, what is the population and how do we define the scope and who are these kids? And if we did try to develop a service response or a residential treatment facility, how many kids are we talking about serving? And so Professor Chris Carey at Portland State University agreed to assist us with compiling that data, and DHS Child Welfare and the Sexual Assault Resource Center up in Portland contributed data to that study, and we quantified the number of kids being sex trafficked in the Portland metro area at 478 children, and those are the children that we could identify, and those were only the children who had had contact with a social service agency, and that was either DHS Child Welfare or the Sexual Assault Resource Center. So we know it's a significantly underrepresented population in terms of our count. But we also thought that would be helpful to this committee and to policymakers and budget planners in terms of this is the population that potentially could be served. if there were a treatment facility available for these kids. Now, as a U.S. attorney, my piece of this, besides the fact that my heart is still with child welfare, is that we prosecute these cases. And we actually have one of the highest prosecution rates of any district in the United States in terms of federal prosecution of sex trafficking. And I'm telling you that we could do 3 times more cases if we could keep victims around long enough, safe enough, stable enough to be able to confront their traffickers in court and in grand jury. We partner with district attorneys all over the state. We have a task force approach. We work collaboratively, and there are a lot of great people who are very dedicated to this issue, not the least of which are the DHS child welfare teams that work, especially in Multnomah County, serving this population, and all of them will tell you the same thing, which is that we are failing these kids. They go to a homeless shelter, they're out the door to the pimp, and they recruit kids to go with them. They go to a psychiatric facility, and it's not designed to meet their needs. They go to foster care, and they're out the door, out the window, overnight. And so we really need some way to keep our children safe from what's really become an epidemic in our community. And I'm going to turn it over to the people who've been doing the work on the ground and tell you where we're at with the solution.
Yeah, good question.
Thanks so much for your investment throughout this whole process. And you kept at us on and on and on, and I really appreciate it. So your input was extremely valuable in this whole process. Representative Gilliam.
Okay, just a quick clarification. When you say high rate of prosecution, are we talking about convictions or?
Yes, and I should just really make it clear that when I say a high rate for my office as a federal prosecutor, we indicted 14 people in 2013, and in 2012 we indicted 12 or 13 individuals for sex trafficking. Now the Multnomah County DA's office indicted 10 times more people. So, you know, like any crime, the state prosecutors are doing the bulk of the criminal prosecutions across our region. My office has really reserved our federal prosecution power to go after the worst, or people who are a particular federal interest. And for us, we've really looked at gang-affiliated pimps. So those are the primary cases that we go after. And I do mean convictions. We haven't lost a single case, and our sentences have ranged from 15 years to life.
I have a quick question, too.
Yes.
And it might be answered by one of the others of you, but you talked about 473 that have actually, you can count because they've had contact. Do you have any guess at what the population might be overall?
I think DHS might know.
Maybe that's part of your presentation.
More than that.
At this point, no.
Yeah, I mean, I would just...
10 times that, 3 times that.
You know, it would be speculation, I think, but I can tell you that at least from law enforcement folks, that they will tell you that they have contact with a lot of kids who, you know, do everything in their power to stay out of contact with the child welfare system or other resources and other care providers. And so at least anecdotally from law enforcement, they seem to think that that is a very small percentage of the number of kids who at any given time are being sex trafficked.
Amanda, before we move on from you, tell us how long it takes to prosecute a case after someone is first arrested, and what is the process? Mm-hmm. What all do you need to prosecute a case?
So the process is really similar in both the state and federal system. The difference is, unfortunately, the federal system tends to take longer. That's just the nature of the culture of the federal courts. But basically the process is, initially a suspect is contacted, arrested, they're placed in custody, they're charged with a crime. Within 24 to 72 hours, they're going to be arraigned in front of a judge, provided with their rights, provided with counsel if they qualify. And then there's going to be, various stages in the proceeding where there are follow-up hearings, but the first thing that's going to happen is a grand jury is going to be scheduled, and a defendant has a right to be indicted by a grand jury, and that's going to hold that charge. That's the first step at which we're going to need a victim to be available to testify. So, grand jury proceeding could take place, any time within the first month of a case, and sometimes the defendants stipulate to more time to get ready for grand jury, and sometimes they don't, but those things can be negotiated. But pretty quickly, from the time that a charge is filed or an arrest is made, a prosecutor needs to get to grand jury, and that's the first time we're going to need a victim to be working with us.
And you need a victim to stay involved for a period of time.
And that's the harder part. Sometimes the initial appearance isn't as difficult, but it's keeping a victim's stable and safe long enough to get to trial. Now, in the state court system, it might take anywhere from, depending on the county and the charge and the complexity of the case, it might take anywhere from 3 months upward to a year to get to a trial. In the federal system, it might take anywhere from 9 months to a year and a half or even longer to get to trial because the delays tend to be more significant. And so so when I talk about the cases that we do and being very proud of having indicted 14 people last year and having not have had to dismiss cases and being able to get guilty pleas and move quickly and get victims into services, that is such a small percentage of the cases that we know about working with the Child Exploitation Task Force. So few cases of the kids that we've identified in this study, 478 kids, and then we're talking about, you know, 14 federal prosecutions. And even though the state does many more cases, you know, if Multnomah County District Attorney was here, and because we've spoken together before, mm-hmm. I know he'd tell you that's exactly his experience as well.
And that's sort of how we got involved with this whole issue.
I have a question.
Yes, Representative
Woodson. I was wondering, how many of these are minority or non-English speaking? Are we seeing a prevalence towards trafficking by certain ethnic
groups? I'm so glad that you asked that question, Representative Whitsett. Representative Tomei, we did look at that in the study that we did at Portland State. One of the things that I neglected to mention that I think is really significant when you're talking about human trafficking, which is a term I try not to use. I usually talk about the issue we're talking about today as CSEC, or the commercial sexual exploitation of children, because I think as a society we've heard so much about human trafficking and people visualize boatloads of young women and girls coming in from Asia or Eastern Europe or even from Mexico or south of the border. And the reality in Oregon, from the law enforcement perspective, from the child welfare perspective, from the data that we've seen, from the victims we interface with, is these are all our kids. They are almost 100% domestic born. Now, there are some outliers. It's not that we don't have a Mexican-born child or a child that's born someplace else, but very rarely, and the kids that we're talking about are U.S.-born, U.S. citizen youth. Now, the kids are trafficked between places in the United States, so it's not uncommon to see kids trafficked in Portland, Tacoma, Seattle, Oakland, Sacramento, Las Vegas, and we track that because they're advertised on the Internet, on backpage.com, so we can see girls that we've had contact with in Portland, and I know your caseworkers have told me the same thing, that they can find their kids online being trafficked in other places, and that's definitely a tactic the pimp uses. But in terms of the racial and ethnic breakdown of the victims, one of the most concerning things about the Portland State study was that 28% of the children, female children being trafficked in Portland, I should also mention that 98% of the victims were female. But 28% of those victims were African American. And again, this study looked primarily at the Portland metro area, and so that's compared with about 6% of African Americans in the general population. So the disproportionality is very concerning. Another concerning data point was that 16% of the girls who were identified had a baby, had given birth. So in terms of the implications for multi-generational child welfare issues, that was another really concerning data point.
Could I follow all that? So I don't know what the right term is. The perpetrators, the mm-hmm. pimps, what are they then? I mean, is it... Can you just
describe
what you're saying there?
Well, we've identified... law enforcement has identified between 300 and 400 active pimps, and generally the pimps that my office, and many of them have multiple victims, they refer to their to the victims as their, quote, stable, and at least from my perspective as a federal prosecutor, and I want to just, you know, caveat this by reminding you that we have an initiative that specifically targets gang members, and we do that through the Portland Metro Gang Task Force and through the FBI's Child Exploitation Task Force, that almost all of our pimps have been African American gang members, but they have not all been African American. We've had Caucasian and other race, but mainly they've been gang affiliated pimps. Although currently we are prosecuting a white female pimp, and we are also prosecuting our very first John under the federal anti-trafficking statute.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
But I do this, think it's important to make restate the point you made. I mean, people do think of sexual trafficking as an international kind of issue, and it's very important, I think, that we recognize it is a local issue, and so that trafficking happens in our backyard. So.
Thank you so much for saying that, Representative Gallegos, and I think it's very important also because this study did focus on the Portland metro area to recognize that it's not just a Portland problem. We have had these cases in Medford. We have had them in Bend. We have had them in Albany. And it's certainly, you know, once you get out of the Portland metro area, the racial demographics are much different. So we've had this happen in nice families, intact families with good students and athletes. And it really is an epidemic.
I don't know. I'm sorry I stepped out for a minute. Did you distinguish between human trafficking and sexual?
I call what we're talking about here today CSEX, so the commercial sexual exploitation of children. It is all human trafficking, but I think it gets really confusing when you morph it together with the foreign-born and labor trafficking issue, which is equally horrific, but just sort of a different conversation from a social services standpoint.
Thank you.
Representative Whitson?
Just one last question. It escaped me. Go ahead.
All right.
All of a sudden, it just popped out.
Well, you have another chance. Anything else? Okay. Thank you so much, Amanda.
Welcome.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice's role in this, we were part of the work group convened by Representative Tomei, and really there were sort of two issues on which we took lead. One was coming out of the 2013 session, we wanted to do an investigation of how Oregon was doing in terms of the sufficiency of our anti-sex trafficking laws, and I mean that in a pretty broad-reaching way, everything from the sufficiency of our victims' rights laws, our forfeiture laws, the criminal penalties themselves. And then the other half of it is we spent some time, once it became clear that there was a real services gap and the need to try to get a shelter together for the victims of sex trafficking as to what that shelter should look like, what best practices were out there, what other models we could encounter, and what lessons we could learn from them. So, and Chair Tomei, feel free to direct me in any particular direction because this will be a broad overview and can't touch on everything. So if you feel I miss anything, please let me know. On the first issue, the Attorney General ultimately convened a symposium to do a sort of step-by-step comparison of Oregon's laws with the model laws issued by the ABA and then the standards issued by the Polaris Project, which specializes in sex trafficking. And again, that ran the gamut in all the ways I previously described. We brought together members of the judiciary. Justice Brewer was there, members of law enforcement, prosecutors on multiple levels, service providers. And as we went through section by section, the conclusion we drew was that Oregon is actually doing fairly well, that our laws are fairly adequate. We heard from prosecutors that they receive robust sentences against pimps and they don't feel like they're lacking legal tools to make those prosecutions. And we heard from defense attorneys that they didn't want to see that increase, didn't feel that it was necessary as well. What everybody came away with from that conversation is that the real failure that we're suffering right now isn't a legislative one. It's not something that we can tackle by making more laws. The fundamental failure of our existing process is identifying these victims as what they are. And I'll say girls, and that's not 100% accurate, but it is reflected by the statistics that they represent the majority. When these girls come into the system, they come in via arrest. They're picked up for prostitution. They're picked up for drug offenses. They're picked up for theft. The moment that they encounter the criminal justice system is the moment where the identification most desperately needs to be made. We heard from a law enforcement detective, Detective Geiger from the Portland Police Bureau, very articulate on this point, that if you don't interact with these girls on a level consistent with their being victimized, if you treat them like criminals, that's it. They have no incentive to come forward after that. Their pimps usually will introduced them a narrative where the pimps are their protectors, they're the only ones who understand them, and law enforcement is in fact just there to take away their freedom and take away their boyfriend or however the pimp is holding himself out to them. So that is the first moment lost. Then they come into the criminal justice system and they're assigned a defense attorney. Now that defense attorney is perhaps the most powerful instrument we'll have, and there's another important opportunity because these are the people who need to build rapport with these girls and need to have the tools and the training to do so, to have that second moment of saying, aha, this girl's been a victim. We need to bring that to the attention of prosecutors who, when they learn that and they have some compelling evidence that these girls are being prosecuted, it presents them with the opportunity for something far more important than dealing with a 16-year-old girl who was picked up on suspicion of shoplifting or prostitution. And finally, the judges, and Justice Dave Brewer was very articulate here, as they're imposing conditions of probation, as they're trying to figure out what services need to be referred, there is a third and very important opportunity. So the work that the Department of Justice is doing now in the aftermath of that legal review isn't quite what we expected. We expected to be putting together a legislative package for 2015. What we're doing now is actually much more complicated. We're trying to figure out how to, from a programmatic and a training level, build awareness, particularly with law enforcement, to say, at that moment of first contact, you need to be able to spot what this is. And that is very hard, because these girls masquerade as shoplifters, drug addicts, any number of things. And they are the last ones who would ever tell you the true nature of that situation until the trust is built. And that trust is never built if you come in on the attack from the get-go. So setting that aside, the other half of DOJ's investigation was oriented towards looking at what has been working with shelters elsewhere. And the first thing I have to tell you is there aren't very many. Just the fact that we're having this discussion puts us very much at the vanguard of the national debate about sex trafficking. There are a few, not very many. The one with which I had the most direct communication was a shelter just outside of Houston. The shelter was the subject of a New York Times article. That's the only way I found it. And I'll just give you a little bit of information about some of the... The sort of important things that we took away here, funding is always such a tricky issue, and that's what almost every shelter we encountered is running into. The federal grant environment is very tricky right now. It's sort of trying to deal with sex trafficking, labor trafficking all at once, and that makes it very hard to accommodate. So the trick is what beyond state funding is available, and we're seeing a definite movement, Representative Gilliam, towards public-private partnerships, and that's something that we've discussed here. Also significant is that I was told vehemently by the director of this shelter that the biggest threat is, in fact, not the pimps. Once the girls get into the shelter, it's the girls' threat to each other. It's a shock to the girls to learn that once they enter the shelter, their pimps aren't actually going to come and rescue them. They're going to abandon them for the system and go looking for more girls. They're not going to risk their own freedom by making that attempt. And they rely on recruitment. As Amanda Marshall stated, this is actually the big danger. They come in, they recruit, they leave. So there's a lot more here, and in fact, I could offer some of it in writing to the committee down the road.
That would be great if you would do that.
But the bottom line, and you'll hear from DHS, I think, about the specifics of the lessons that we've taken away, but we're optimistic going forward.
And Aaron also had been involved from the very beginning. We met for months, and not only Aaron, but his boss, Ellen Rosenblum. Senator Wyden sent staff. Senator Wyden himself came to one of the meetings. Multnomah County, Diane McKeel came. So it was a very, very intense group that met together in my very crowded dining room for several months. So thank you so much. So now let's move on. We do have some state money. We have a plan. So let's talk about what that will be.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. I'm about ready to take you into the weeds of where we're at with the plan. So I've had the good luck of stepping into all the hard work that's come before me in terms of the various committees that folks have done.
Could you tell us your name?
Yeah, sorry. I knew I was going to forget that. Amy Baker. I'm the Child and Family Mental Health Manager with Addictions and Mental Health for the Oregon Health Authority.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So basically, I stepped into the coattails of everybody's hard work And last September, we were allocated $2.3 million from the September 2013 special session, which was a continuation of the mental health funding. And we're charged to develop residential services for this population. And you would think that would be a relatively easy task. I've certainly designed RFPs before in my time. And so we sat down and started to write an RFP, and we'd get into it a little ways and then realize we had all kinds of unanswered questions. So my team and I started calling said programs around the country, thinking, why not? It would be super helpful to learn from what other folks have done, basically asking them, if you had the chance to do this over again, what would you do differently? And boy, did we find a lot of really interesting information. Also talked to the place in Houston, and as we were speaking to them, they were building a fence to basically keep girls from running impulsively, even though the facility is really quite remote. And so that conversation led to another conversation. We went all over the map, being very conscientious of not wanting to release an RFP that we were fearful wouldn't be effective. The challenge is, of course, there are no evidence-based practices when it comes to this population. There are a few shelters, they haven't been around for a long amount of time, and they certainly haven't been researched. Collaborated with DHS and their team around bringing in national technical assistance, more conversations, and we finally landed on a model that I think coalesced all the different information that we've been given, which included things like not having the young kids with the older kids, because obviously it's really developmentally not appropriate. Thinking about how to do cottages, about how to have a bigger facility, but to try to keep smaller units so that when you have one kid run, they don't take everybody. And so we basically have a basic conceptualization around a residential program serving girls age 11 to 15. That it's a program that would have education within it and hopefully medical services as well, because the more we can minimize going off campus, the less risk there is to run. And that there would be mental health services attached to that, but that they wouldn't be required, because a lot of these girls don't really see that they have mental health problems. In fact, often they don't see that they have problems at all. And it's very similar to working with victims of domestic violence or folks who have Stockholm syndrome. And so while they clearly have mental health issues, we just have to be really careful about how it is that we address that. So we, AMH, released a request for information about 2 weeks ago. Purpose of that being, I wanted to make sure that somebody was actually interested in applying for the RFP. Nothing's more scary than submitting a request for proposal and nobody bids on it. And two, to give the community the last opportunity to give us feedback around informing that process. Based on my limited experience with this, nobody agrees on what anybody should do. And so this is really going to be a work in progress. We're going to have to learn as we go. We expect that this is going to be it's going to be one program, hopefully, in a continuum of services. It's not going to be the end-all, be-all. It's not going to meet every kid's needs. There are more services that we need to add that maybe better serve another population, but we see it as being a very important service. Our desired outcomes, we expect that these girls are going to run, and that we're going to get them, and we're going to bring them back again. We're going to hold their bed open, and we're going to keep working with them. We expect that we're going to get them involved in school, that we're going to find them healthy adult attachment figures. That's one of the biggest challenges, and these girls think they have an attachment to their pimp. And without some sort of a replacement relationship, we're unlikely to be successful. We expect that how we measure success is going to be based on the positive activities that they're involved in, the fact that they're going to school. If they run, they come back. And the eventual goal obviously being that we get them out of the life.
Chair, can I ask a question, please?
Yes,
Gregson. Can I ask a question, please? Can you clarify something for me? I'm always hesitant to think in terms of mental health issues with children, with adolescents even. Mm-hmm. And so you are talking about a mental health perspective here with these mm-hmm. young women. How can you expand on that, or how does that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, I'd be happy to. There is a significant percentage of these girls who have experienced sexual abuse in their home and physical abuse. Whether they openly acknowledge that or are able to address that, it absolutely impacts their ability to function. In fact, part of what helps them survive in the life is what helped them survive in their original family situation.
Right. But is that a mental health issue? I don't see that as a...
I believe it's a mental health issue. The formal definition would be post-traumatic stress disorder. But the reality is a lot of the kids that we work with have traumatic experiences that impact their ability to function, and that is a responsibility of the mental health system to address that.
And I'm asking this only in terms of the treatment that gets assigned to this label and also the dollars that get assigned to that label. So I just wanted to make sure that that's what we're talking about.
Yes.
Thank you.
I remembered my question, and it was related to how many of these girls have drug addiction problems, that they need the pimp in order to keep a regular supply of drugs?
Chair Tomei, Representative Witsit, that is a very good question. You are right on with that question. There is a high percentage of these girls who have drug addictions. I'm looking at Amanda Marshall because she seems to be able to whip statistics off the top of her head.
Well, I can say that our study with PSU indicated a pretty low percentage, and that was based primarily, as I said, on the SARC and DHS data. I want to say it was something like, it was less than 50%, and everybody thought that was wrong.
Yeah.
And then we compared it to a recent statistical study done by Multnomah County Juvenile Department, and their director there had it was somewhere upwards of 85% of the CSEC population had an identified substance abuse issue. So we do think it's high.
So
follow up.
Perhaps a treatment, addiction treatment, would be the first step before we go into further mental health definition. I mean, let's try and get him clean first, and that's probably why they're running away, too, because you're essentially taking their source of drugs away from them then. So they want to flee to get back to the drugs.
Chair Tomei, Representative Wilson. I think we really have to think about both at the same time. And it's when I think about mental health treatment, I'm not talking about counseling, because I don't think these girls are going to respond very well to, you know, tell me about how you feel. I think it's the lens in which you approach to work with them and understanding what kind of history and past they've had. And absolutely, addictions counseling is going to be a part of that. But part of the reason why these young girls use is they're trying to cover up a lot of the pain from some of their histories that have happened to them. And so really, you have to address both at the same time.
Go ahead. Marita, do you want to contribute to this discussion?
Chair Tomei, my name is Marita Johnson, and I'm the Deputy Child Welfare Director, and I'd like to talk about how we are building on with this initiative. Ms. Baker spoke earlier about some technical assistance that we've applied for and received through the National Resource Center for Permanency and Family Connections. They have helped us develop a strategic plan to address this in a more global way. They are helping us with some peer-to-peer conversations with other residential treatment facilities across the country. So as we build this one, we can continue to be thinking through what works and be refining our treatment facilities. They are also gathering other states' strategic plans that address child trafficking and pulling them together for us so we can look at what other states are doing and then be able to pull the strengths of those state plans and be able to look at how they might mirror some of our other existing collaborations. So they're doing that for us. They will be coming out and holding a stakeholder meeting for us so we can pull people together to be able to start talking about how we can really develop our own broad strategic plan to address this population. We're very concerned about how this population is being affected in other parts of the state. We feel very fortunate to have the work that's been done in Portland, and the greatest fear is that work will be so perfected that the trafficking behavior will really start popping up in other parts of the state. So we want to be very proactive to be able to address the needs of kids in Medford and address the needs of kids in Klamath Falls. We're already hearing about issues in Hood River, Bend. Particularly worried about that back alley of Highway 97 that runs from border to border and then connects up with the ability to go east and west and into Washington. So we're very excited about engaging their assistance. They're very happy about working with us. And the best part about it is it's free technical assistance to us through the Children's Bureau. So that's where our peace lies, and we hope to continue to move forward and have our own strategic plan that really touches all the partners and partnerships that this issue touches. So,
and we're also looking at federal money also, as I said earlier that Senator Wyden was very involved in this issue and has been for some years. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking at other ways of raising money, certainly with the nonprofits. We met with several nonprofits about their involvement in this. So it's really an exciting program. And we're hoping this is going to grow, not just in our state, but throughout the country. I think that's the message which you're getting from the federal people, that this is a great start, and I think there's a lot of excitement. I also want to say that also the Multnomah County DA's office had been involved, the Portland police and other police officers, Department of Justice, as I said. Who else was there? The Multnomah County...
service providers.
Service providers, yeah. So we had a large group that was invested in this. So how many girls, we're looking at girls between 11 and 15, so how large a population are we looking at in the first? And you're putting out an RFP, and when will that be going out within the next?
We're putting out an RFP, hopefully to be released in the next 3 weeks, and we're looking at, we're basically looking at a 12-bed facility. And again, I know that's nothing compared to the numbers that were just mm-hmm. quoted.
Right, but it's a start.
But it's a start, and it's one piece of the system, and we need to keep building from there.
Right, and if we're successful with this system, we can certainly grow this right. throughout the state and throughout the country. So let's see, Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I just want to say I'm just so aware that how important the terminology we use is. I mean, just the fact that the feds... At least my understanding, the last I looked at this, was that the federal government still thought of this as an international issue. And the funding for local interventions was very limited. I don't know if that's changed or not. But I was also thinking that, you know, depending on what you call this stuff, I mean, even the National Center for Child Abuse and Neglect might be something we could look at. But and I'm glad to hear that the federal delegation, Senator Wyden, is looking at this as maybe can help us sort of think through these distinctions.
Yeah. Thank you. We're losing people. Representative Witzig, go ahead.
I just want to say, and you're very aware of it, I know, because I've talked to some members of your panel, but your sex trafficking, what you're describing is... essentially along your major drug trafficking, when you talk about going up Highway 97 and you have Klamath Falls and you have Bend and you have mm-hmm. Hood River, and then you have the points going east and north. But, I mean, what you're describing is very much what we see in the cartel also drug routes, that they are distributing methamphetamine and heroin and cocaine along. So they probably are like that to some degree. So,
any last points? Anything we missed?
I do think it's really important to pick up on something that Aaron said, and sort of the reason why DHS is at the table is when he talks about what happens now in terms of missed opportunities, I want to say it's not necessarily been my experience that police officers, especially in Portland, because we've had so much training and so much outreach, don't identify victims or know what to do or want to do the right thing to help. It's that they don't have any place to bring the victims other than detention. So the solution is not to change everything, to focus on what law enforcement needs to do differently with this population. It's to change the way we look at these victims from delinquent youth to dependent youth. And so that it's a different system that has to be created to serve the population the way they need to be served, as victims of crime, not as criminals. So I just wanted to make that point, and then also to just express a wee bit of concern about the RFP age of 15. The Portland State study identified that the average age of onset of first contact with the social service provider of somebody identified as a CSEC victim was 15. And I can tell you that, at least from the prosecution angle, it's not going to solve our problem if that's the cutoff age, because most of the kids that we see as victims in court, both in the state and federal level, are between the ages of 15 and 18. So that's just a slight concern.
I can understand that. I think this is a start.
Yeah.
This is going to be the population that perhaps we can have the most impact on to begin with. And I certainly don't see this as the end. We'll be moving further on this issue. So thanks for that point. That's a good point. Thank you for your work. Good luck with this, and we'll be hearing more from you. With that, we're going to close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And thanks to all of my people on the left.
Don't even go there.